Chapter 4. Race and Economics. Race does not change the fundamental principles of economics. However, the application of economic principles in a racially and culturally heterogeneous population introduces complications beyond those found in the analysis of economic transactions in homogeneous populations. Cultural differences between groups are reflected in their roles as workers, consumers, entrepreneurs, tenants, or other economic transactors. As the history of various racial and ethnic groups has shown repeatedly, such groups differ greatly in their specific job skills, general work habits, occupational preferences, business traditions, educational backgrounds, thriftiness, and many other factors affecting economic results. The study of economic results is a study of cause and effect. Philosophical observations, moral lamentations, or political rhetoric are not economic analysis. What economics can contribute to an understanding of the incomes, occupations, and general material well-being of racial and ethnic groups is a systematic analysis of the incentives existing under different market conditions. The consequences of such incentives follow general economic principles which have emerged over a period of centuries of study of markets, prices, incomes, profit rates, and other such variables. The economics of race is essentially the application of those principles to heterogeneous populations. The markets in which individuals and groups transact are also heterogeneous, some highly competitive and others under various forms of control by government, labor unions, business cartels, and the like. Add to this the sweeping range of things that are bought and sold, from bread to stock options and from clothing to oil wells, and the possible combinations of heterogeneous groups and heterogeneous markets are virtually limitless. However, the general principles of economics, as applied to racial and ethnic groups, can be illustrated in three broad kinds of transactions: those involving employment, housing, and the sale of consumer goods and services. Employment. Employment is obviously a crucial economic factor, whether for individuals or groups. The kind of occupation in which someone is employed affects not only current earnings and the way of life that this makes possible, but also future prospects for the individual and the individual's children, including their education and careers. Occupations differ not only in current rates of pay, but also in the likelihood of future unemployment, both of which affect the level of prosperity of individuals and groups. However, despite the great importance of occupations and earnings in setting upper limits to current living standards, and to the rate of saving for the future, history repeatedly shows how mistaken it is to regard those limits as tightly constricting over time, and how completely misleading it is to label particular occupations dead-end jobs or particular wage levels as subsistence. In country after country, immigrants from China, Italy, or Japan, for example, have begun at the bottom of the occupational ladder in arduous, unskilled, menial, and low-paid work, often in jobs disdained by the local population. Yet, with the passing years and generations, these immigrant groups have typically risen above the average incomes and occupational levels of those around them. Current earnings did not predetermine future earnings, as vicious cycle of poverty theories claim. Some poverty is indeed persistent across generations, but the differences between those individuals and groups who remain mired in poverty and those who advance must be sought in other factors besides their initial earnings. Likewise, people working for what others characterized as subsistence wages have often saved a significant part of their incomes and used it to establish small businesses, buy homes, or otherwise contribute to their own advancement. Similarly, so-called dead-end jobs do not predetermine the future. Italians once predominated among people shining shoes in New York and in such Brazilian cities as Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, and Santos, and such an occupation epitomizes the dead-end job which has no promotional ladder attached to it. Yet Italians rose from such jobs probably no less rapidly than people working in civil service or other jobs with preset promotional ladders. The Chinese in colonial Malaya often began as unskilled laborers on the rubber plantations or in the tin mines. The savings from their earnings on such jobs later enabled them to begin small, precarious businesses which eventually prospered. At the beginning of the 20th century, Japanese immigrants in the United States were agricultural field hands and domestic servants to an even greater extent than their black contemporaries. Yet the Japanese rose from such occupations within the lifetime of the first generation, and the second generation began at higher levels, in wholly different sectors of the economy, largely as a result of education. In short, while occupations are an important influence on the immediate economic prospects of an individual or group, these occupations are hardly all-determining in the long run, even for a given individual. In some cases, immigrants' rises from humble beginnings have simply reflected a return to higher positions held before immigrating. Immigrants who had been professionals in pre-Castro Cuba often began in much lower occupations in the United States in order to support themselves until they could re-establish their professional careers. In an earlier era, Jews from Eastern Europe brought with them needle trade skills and entrepreneurial experience, which took some time to turn into business ownership in America's garment industry. These situations must be distinguished from the situations of Chinese, Italian, or Japanese immigrants, who more usually brought with them neither skills nor entrepreneurial experience. In both sets of circumstances, however, neither the initial occupations nor the earnings levels in those occupations were the determining factor in the long-run economic results. In racially and culturally heterogeneous societies, employment prospects for individuals and groups often vary not only with their own skills and work patterns, but also with their acceptability to co-workers, customers, or employers. Where particular groups are less acceptable to others, that can lead to their being segregated, either in particular business establishments or in different business establishments in the same or other industry. This job segregation may or may not be accompanied by discrimination in earnings received. Racially and culturally heterogeneous groups are also affected differently by wage controls, occupational licensing laws, or other governmental policies, whether or not these policies explicitly or intentionally make racial distinctions. Employment segregation. As with other uses of the term segregation, employment segregation as a policy or act of employers must be distinguished from the mere existence of a pattern in which different groups choose different occupations or have qualifications for a different set of jobs. The dearth of Japanese Americans or Hispanic Americans among professional basketball players has seldom, if ever, aroused charges of group segregation or discrimination, for the unusual tallness of professional basketball players makes it unlikely that groups with below average height would be well represented there. Nor is the underrepresentation of whites in professional basketball attributed to anything other than the unusual interest and skill in basketball among blacks. A group once well represented in basketball, the Jews, no longer is, as alternative employment opportunities in other fields have attracted them away over the years. The exodus of Irish Americans from boxing, where they once dominated, has likewise followed their rise in alternative careers. In short, segregation as an employer policy cannot be inferred from group representation statistics, which are readily influenced by the varying skills and choices of the groups themselves. This is not to deny that deliberate group segregation by employers has existed and continues to exist, but rather to point out that mere numbers do not define or demonstrate its existence. Group segregation as a deliberate policy or action by employers is a very old and widespread phenomenon. During the era of mass migration to the United States, American employers discovered that putting Irish and Italian immigrants in the same work crew produced a high probability of violence, especially if these were jobs that required the workers to live together for long periods of time, in crews constructing railroads or canals, for example. Indeed, employing Italians whose origins were in different parts of Italy created the same potential for violence. Migratory agricultural laborers have likewise tended to be racially or ethnically homogeneous groups, spending months living together as they work. Often they have been recruited and managed by someone of their own racial or ethnic background, whether that be Mexican, Italian, West Indian, or other. Differences of language, as well as intergroup animosities, can lead to such segregation policies, whether or not the employer himself has any antipathy toward any of the groups in question. Moreover, such segregation does not in itself imply that one group is paid more or less than others, or is used for higher or lower occupations. That is a separate question, and one with varying answers according to circumstances. What job segregation of this sort does imply is that there are higher costs of employing mixed groups of incompatible workers than employing more homogeneous groups of workers, whether those costs originate in language differences, lifestyle differences, or intergroup animosities. In other words, the higher costs are inherent. There are no solutions to this problem that will make it disappear without incurring other costs. Looked at another way, intergroup incompatibilities can raise production costs, whether through interruptions of work by arguments or fights, through mistakes in communication because of workers misunderstanding each other's language, or because an atmosphere of tension in the workplace lowers morale in general or causes a firm to lose its best workers, who are more likely to have job alternatives available elsewhere in less tense surroundings. In some cases, the higher costs of mixed workforces are due to different groups of workers wanting different working conditions. In an earlier era, for example, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe often did not want to work on Saturdays, their Sabbath, in American factories. Because factories of that era typically operated 6 days a week, the cost of having mixed Jewish and Christian work crews would have been to have part of the workforce absent on each of 2 days a week, instead of having everyone absent when the business closed down on Sunday. The costs entailed by such scheduling difficulties would vary from industry to industry, and would be complicated by changing ratios of Jews to Gentiles with normal labor turnover over time. In any event, under these conditions, there were lower production costs when Jews and Christians were employed in separate business establishments, whether in the same or different industries. Because this was in fact a cheaper way to produce output, the pressures of economic competition in the product market would favor the survival of firms with either all Jewish or all Gentile workforces, whether or not the owners of these firms were Jews or Gentiles, whether or not these owners and employers had any animosity toward the other group, and irrespective of whether Jews or Gentiles were better workers. Both in Tsarist Russia and on the Lower East Side of New York during the immigrant era, it was common for Jewish workers to have Jewish employers. In such situations, however, there is no economic reason to expect one group of workers to be paid more than the other for the same work, performed with the same efficiency. In places where there were few Jews, and work schedules were geared to the Christian majority's preferences for having Sundays off, it would be difficult for Jewish workers to find a full range of jobs open to them, consistent with Saturday religious observances. Again, this was not a problem with a costless solution. However such a dilemma might be resolved, higher costs would result, whether to the business or to Jewish individuals. Over time, after rising productivity made possible 2-day closures of businesses on the weekend, both Jewish and Gentile employees could be off at the same time, observing their respective Sabbaths, and so could be employed in the same business establishments without such costs. While employment segregation does not in itself necessarily imply different earnings for different groups, there are circumstances which can lead to such pay differences, and other circumstances that do not. To the extent that different groups have, each within itself, the full range of complementary economic factors, management as well as labor, skilled as well as unskilled workers, alternative businesses can be set up to accommodate the lower costs of segregated employment without either labor or management earning any less than in other firms producing the same output. However, to the extent that one group lacks one or more complementary factors required to create a whole business establishment, if they lack management or skilled labor, for example, then they may either face poorer prospects of being hired or have to accept lower rates of pay to induce others to employ them. Those workers and managers who belong to the majority or to other minorities with a full range of entrepreneurial and job skills cannot be paid less than their compatriots elsewhere, or they will go elsewhere themselves. Therefore, any costs associated with unsegregated employment, whether due to differences in language or religion or to antipathy, will tend to fall on those groups without the alternative of establishing their own businesses. To establish by law the principle of equal pay for equal work increases the likelihood of the minorities not being hired at all, and to establish group hiring quotas where they live increases the chances that employers will locate away from where they live, whether in other parts of the country or overseas. This is because the costs are real, not simply a matter of perceptions or stereotypes, and such laws do not reduce these costs. The extent to which there are additional costs associated with unsegregated hiring is an empirical question, and no doubt varies from place to place and from time to time. However, even during the Jim Crow era in the American South, blacks were seldom paid less by an employer for doing the same job as white employees. Rather, blacks were excluded from certain higher-paying jobs that would have put them on the same plane as whites. In the South especially, the resistance of whites was not so much to physical proximity to blacks, but rather to associating with them on a plane of equality. Blacks were welcome to live in white homes as servants, even by whites who would refuse to sit down at the same table with blacks to discuss business, for the latter implied equality, while the former and more intimate association did not. Employment discrimination. Discrimination is easier to define in concept than to determine in practice. Numerous demonstrable differences between groups in skills, education, and experience, for example, make it difficult to tell whether intergroup differences in pay or occupations reflect those productivity differences or instead represent arbitrarily lower pay to different groups performing similar tasks with similar efficiency. Moreover, discrimination against a group as a whole must be distinguished from discrimination against particular individuals within a group. Group discrimination might imply, for example, that the average Maharashtrian in Bombay is paid less than the average Gujarati or South Indian is paid for performing the same work with the same degree of efficiency. This kind of discrimination, however, is usually very costly to a private employer in a competitive market. Where the victimized groups can form their own businesses, they can sell the resulting output in the product market, where consumers seldom care who produced the products they buy. The fact that other employers refuse to pay what their productivity would otherwise command only means that they earn the same wages, profits, interest, etc., by forming their own businesses. This, however, is not the only way in which attempted discrimination can fail. Moreover, it is not merely that the targeted victims can escape discrimination under these particular conditions. Those attempting to discriminate in this way incur needless costs in a competitive market. The costs of employment discrimination take many forms and vary with many factors. If two groups of equal productivity are paid significantly different wage rates for doing the same job, then employers who hire the lower paid group stand to make more profit and, over time, to displace their business rivals who have imposed higher labor costs on themselves by hiring labor at pay rates above what is necessary to get the work done. Given that businessmen are in business to make money rather than to promote particular social views, even highly prejudiced employers seldom persist in this costly kind of discrimination. Indeed, the entire social history of white-ruled South Africa was a history of white employers resisting and evading government policies mandating employment discrimination against blacks. There is no compelling reason to believe that these employers had radically different racial views from those of other South African whites of that era. What was different was that employers would incur large costs in carrying out the kind of employment discrimination which the South African government sought to impose. The net effect was that blacks were often hired in larger numbers and in higher occupations than permitted by law, even during the era of apartheid. Where groups differ in their productivity, pay differences which exceed those productivity differences are still discriminatory. So obviously is a refusal to hire qualified applicants because they simply belong to the wrong racial or ethnic group. Either kind of discrimination is costly to the employer. In the first case, discriminating employers pay more than necessary whenever they hire someone from the group they prefer. In the second case, when they refuse to hire applicants from other groups, they must either take longer to fill their vacancies or accept less qualified people, or pay more to attract a larger pool of applicants from which to select fully qualified people solely from the preferred group. Meanwhile, those competing employers who are either less prejudiced or more aware of the costs of discrimination get their work done cheaper. These employers with lower production costs can afford to undersell the discriminating firms in the product market while still making a profit, and in fact, earning that profit on more units sold because of cheaper prices. If discriminating employers choose simply to let the job vacancies remain unfilled longer rather than resort to higher pay rates, then this either leads to delays in filling customers' orders, implying slower sales and perhaps a loss of impatient customers, or resorting to overtime work at premium pay to get the work done on time with a shorthanded workforce. The particular choices made may vary with the employer or the industry, but the costs of discrimination remain inescapable in a competitive marketplace and vary only in the form they take. A very different kind of discrimination occurs and can persist even in a competitive market when a particular group is less productive than others, but individuals within that group are just as productive as anyone else. Here the cost of discrimination must compete with the cost of knowledge. If the average Irish immigrant in 19th century America was more beset with alcohol problems affecting his work performance, or was otherwise more troublesome or less productive, then many employers would be reluctant to hire the Irish for jobs where such deficiencies could prove costly. At the same time, there were also Irishmen who did not drink at all, who were productive, cooperative, and were otherwise desirable workers. The cost of sorting out such individuals from their compatriots was not always negligible, and the smaller their proportion, the less likely was the sorting to be worth the effort. For certain demanding kinds of jobs, it was cheaper to use the stock phrase of the time, "No Irish need apply." It is bitter medicine to the fully qualified individual to be denied employment because of the racial, ethnic, or other group to which he belongs. It is economically fallacious, however, to say that the below-average earnings of the group as a whole are due to such discrimination. Were the whole group's average productivity underestimated, the opportunities for less prejudiced or more profit-minded employers would be too great for gross misperceptions to survive the competition of the marketplace. This conclusion is not simply an expression of optimism, but of empiricism. Even when markets are not fully competitive, but have elements of collusion, the pressures of the marketplace can still be formidable. In the period after the American Civil War, whites in the South organized cartels designed to hold down the earnings of blacks who worked for them, either directly as employees or as sharecroppers on their land. But as long as the cartel set earnings of blacks understated their actual productivity, it was profitable for individual white employers to hire blacks away from their competitors at higher pay, or to allow black sharecroppers a higher percentage of the crop. The net result was that these white cartels collapsed all across the South, amid bitter recriminations among whites. Later organized attempts of California employers to hold down the wages of Japanese immigrants in the early 20th century likewise collapsed under the stress of employer competition for labor. Though not an economist, W.E.B. Du Bois recognized the distinction between underpaying a group as a whole and underpaying particular individuals who were more productive than the average of their group. In 1899, Du Bois wrote, "The individual black workman is rated not by his own efficiency, but by the efficiency of a whole group of black fellow workmen, which may often be low." If white people were to lose their racial prejudices overnight, he said, this would make very little immediate difference in the economic condition of most blacks. According to Du Bois, some few would be promoted, some few would get new places, but the mass would remain as they are, until the younger generation began to try harder, until the idle and discouraged were stimulated and the whole race lost the omnipresent excuse for failure, prejudice. Whatever the degree of accuracy of Du Bois's observations, the important conceptual point is that he distinguished discrimination against an individual from discrimination against the group. The former could not explain why one group earned less than another. Clearly, an end to racial discrimination would have made an enormous difference in the career of Du Bois himself. Initially an academic scholar, he was barred by race alone from teaching at the leading universities. Similarly, such multi-talented individuals as Paul Robeson were greatly handicapped by racial barriers. Eventually, both Du Bois and Robeson became embittered communists. In other countries as well, individuals far in advance of their own respective racial or ethnic groups have been so galled at being denied economic opportunities or social acceptance that they became leaders of movements to overthrow existing authorities and the existing social and economic order. Such political responses have not been the only responses, however. A common economic response to being individually undervalued because of sorting costs has been for those with lower sorting costs to employ the undervalued individuals. Other members of the same group often can sort their compatriots at lower costs, either because of specific knowledge of the individual or his family available within the group, or because of a greater facility in reading cultural cues peculiar to the group. The simplest case is when employers within the group hire workers from their own racial or ethnic background. However, labor contractors from within the group may also take on the sorting role, supplying workers whom they have selected to employers in the larger society, and in some cases coming along with them as supervisors and as arrangers of their housing, transportation, and food in the case of migrant work crews, agricultural or industrial. This comprehensive role for labor contractors was once common among Italians and other Mediterranean immigrants, whether in Australia or the Western Hemisphere. Yet another way in which undervalued individuals can be sorted out is self-employment. The individual's own cost of knowledge of his capability and conscientiousness being less than anyone else's cost of acquiring the same knowledge. Self-employment need have no large initial capital requirements, as bootblacks, rag pickers, hawkers, and others demonstrate. Although such occupations have been labeled dead-end jobs, they have often provided not only immediate subsistence, but also stepping stones to other occupations, through money saved, experience acquired, and reputation built. It was not uncommon for a Jewish peddler, beginning with either a backpack or a pushcart, eventually to open a small shop, which could later grow into a larger store, sometimes even a department store, and in a few instances, eventually, a nationwide chain of department stores. Jews went through this progression in societies as far apart as Australia and the United States. On a more modest level, Italian immigrants in Britain, France, Australia, Argentina, and the United States often worked as street musicians, a form of self-employment that could, for the more talented, lead to careers in music. In these and many other ways, undervalued individuals escaped limits set by outsiders' lack of knowledge and high sorting costs. A special form of self-employment that was once prominent during the era of mass immigration to the United States was performing work on assignment in the home. Clothing manufacturers, for example, would supply material to be sewed together in workers' homes, paying on a piece rate basis for the completed work. Jews on the Lower East Side of New York were prominent among both workers and employers in the garment industry. Working at home minimized problems of language differences, Sabbath observances, finding kosher food, avoiding intergroup friction, or prior determination of productivity by employers. Groups such as the Italians, who did not want women to be working outside the home, also found the homework system fit their cultural values. Work at home often involved the whole family, including children young enough that parents were reluctant to send them out to work among strangers, or to leave them to roam the streets while their parents were away. None of these advantages came free. With so many poor immigrants flooding into the United States, their competition for work at home drove the rates of pay so low that a family had to supply many hours of work from its members to earn a living. Labor in the garment industry, whether performed at home or in factories, was often worked long and hard at relatively low rates of pay per piece or per hour. It was sweatshop labor. Social critics and reformers often referred to sweatshop labor as exploited. Yet the more candid, like journalist reformer Jacob Riis, admitted that the sweatshop employer himself often received a thin and precarious profit margin, and bankruptcies were not uncommon in this highly competitive industry. The real beneficiaries were the masses of ordinary consumers, who were enabled to buy new, mass-produced clothes within the limits of their own wealth-generating capacity. The benefits of affordable clothing have become so much taken for granted in later times that it is easily overlooked that this widespread availability of new clothes was a social revolution in the last quarter of the 19th century. Before, even in a relatively prosperous country like the United States, many of the clothing needs of ordinary working-class people were met by homemade clothes or by second-hand clothes acquired through the marketplace or hand-me-down clothes received from older family members. New store-bought clothes were rarer, and all clothing was worn longer before being discarded. Second-hand clothes were health hazards that spread diseases as they changed hands, so that the growing availability of new, cheap, mass-produced clothing represented an advance in disease control, as well as in the general standard of living. The historical picture of sweatshop conditions in the poverty-stricken slums of the 19th century has often been invoked in the 20th century to bar home work of a sort bearing no resemblance to such conditions. Both 19th-century sweatshop workers and 19th-century consumers were severely limited by the much smaller wealth-generating capacities of that era. It was not the banning of sweatshop labor, but the enormous increase in wealth-generating capacity that raised American workers to higher levels of prosperity over the years, while enabling consumers to buy their products around the world. Cheap labor. It has become an oft-repeated statement among scholars as well as journalists that employers have sought or directly imported cheap, unskilled labor from abroad, often members of a different racial or ethnic group. While this has in fact happened in some countries, it has also often been the case that the labor imported has been no cheaper than the labor locally available, especially when transportation and other costs borne by the employer are counted, but has been imported for its greater productivity or reliability. In East Africa, for example, workers were imported from India at considerable expense to build the railroad from Mombasa to Lake Victoria, in preference to using the local Africans. Even when the work is simple, unskilled labor, it may be performed with enough difference to lead to significant differences in pay. In colonial Malaya, Chinese laborers were paid substantially more than Indian laborers for doing the same work, simply because the Chinese produced more output. What is salient in cases like these is not that the labor is cheap in terms of payment per unit of time, but that the cost of getting the work done is lower because the workers are more diligent, reliable, skilled, or careful. In short, the cheap labor cliché confuses earnings per unit of time and production costs per unit of output. Differences in productivity mean that the two are neither identical nor necessarily correlated. Cheaper local workers may in fact be more expensive in terms of what it costs to get a given task accomplished, even if their low pay causes observers to think of them as exploited. Differences in worker productivity do not imply differences in specific skills. Even so-called unskilled labor is far from homogeneous. In addition, much technically skilled labor has also been imported at considerable expense from the days of colonial America to the time of Soviet industrialization under Stalin. Workers are imported for their assets, whether skills or diligence, and not for such liabilities as being unskilled. Cheap unskilled labor may be an attractive phrase for writers, but historically such workers have not been nearly as attractive to employers. Government policy. In addition to market responses to the underlying constraints which produce such phenomena as employment segregation or sweatshop labor, there have also been political responses to such labor market phenomena. A variety of government policies have evolved over the years in many countries to set minimum wage levels, outlaw discrimination, ban home work, and in general regulate the labor market politically. The rationales and intentions of such policies are a matter of social or political philosophy. The actual consequences of such policies, however, are a matter of economics. These consequences may be racially disparate, even when neither the rationale nor the intention has any racial aspect. Minimum wage laws are an example of government policy usually imposed with no racial or ethnic purpose, but which nevertheless has major racial or ethnic effects. Economics, as applied to homogeneous groups, predicts that raising wage rates artificially above their market level, whether by a minimum wage law, a labor union contract, or otherwise, tends to reduce the amount of labor demanded by employers, while simultaneously increasing the amount of labor supplied by workers at the higher and more attractive wage rate. The net result is a surplus of job applicants, unemployment. Numerous empirical studies by economists have confirmed this tendency of minimum wage laws, for example, to reduce employment among those affected. These studies differ on the magnitude of the effect, which varies with the time period covered and the research methods used in particular studies. The economics of heterogeneous groups takes this analysis a step further. Where a group is less in demand, whether because of lower skill levels, less energetic or less conscientious work, or because of others' aversion to associating with them, an artificially imposed wage rate increase tends to increase their unemployment rate more than the unemployment rate of the general population or of other workers in the same affected sectors or wage brackets. When an employer has a surplus of job applicants, those considered less desirable, for whatever reasons, are likely to be overrepresented among the rejected applicants. Thus, for example, when inexperienced teenage workers are covered by the same minimum wage as experienced older workers, the resulting unemployment is likely to be higher among the teenagers. When there are racial or ethnic differences as well, those teenagers from the group less in demand will tend to be especially overrepresented among the unemployed. Black teenagers in the United States were especially hard hit by minimum wage rates, which escalated after 1950. The American Minimum Wage Law, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, remained essentially unchanged until 1950. By that time, the inflation that began during World War II had, in effect, repealed the law by raising wage rates for even unskilled workers above the level specified in the Act. As of that time, teenage unemployment was not appreciably higher than that of older workers, and black and white teenagers also had very similar unemployment rates. Beginning in 1950, however, Congress passed a series of minimum wage increases over the years, while also spreading the coverage of the law to new low-wage sectors that had been exempt previously. Over the next three decades, teenage unemployment rose relative to the unemployment of older workers, and black teenage unemployment rose far above white teenage unemployment. By the 1970s, black teenage unemployment had risen to several times what it had been in 1950. At no time during the three decades after 1950, not even in the most prosperous years, was black teenage unemployment as low as it had been in 1949, a recession year. Although the economic consequences of this sort do not depend on an intention to affect different groups differently, in some countries and at some periods of history, minimum wage laws have in fact been instituted for the express purpose of causing one group to lose jobs which another group gains. In South Africa during the 1920s, a minimum wage law was passed as part of a wider program of deliberately displacing black workers for the benefit of white workers. In Canada, at about the same time, a minimum wage law was passed for the purpose of displacing Japanese workers for the benefit of white workers. During the era of the British Empire, British manufacturers were vocal advocates of government imposition of higher wage rates in India, ostensibly out of humanitarian concern for Indian workers, though the clear self-interest of British manufacturers was in making India's labor artificially more expensive to the benefit of British businesses competing with Indian businesses. It might seem that groups less in demand would be employed less, whether or not there was a minimum wage law. However, as the earlier pattern of black teenage unemployment showed, groups that are less in demand can be employed as much as other groups. In fact, every U.S. census from 1890 to 1950 showed blacks to have a higher labor force participation rate than whites. As with many other economic phenomena, the crucial factor here was price, in this case, the price of labor. Where wage rates are free to vary with the productivity of workers, a worker with half the productivity is just as employable at a lower wage as a worker with twice the productivity at a higher wage. The widespread 19th century practice of paying piece rates based on output, rather than wages based on time at work, further facilitated the hiring of people with differing productivities. The later increased use of wages based on hours worked, and still more so of annual salaries not closely tied to hours or output, has moved pay and productivity farther apart. Both tendencies, often promoted by those wishing to help workers, create incentives for employers to establish productivity levels below which workers become unemployable, even though these same workers would have been perfectly employable in the era of piece rates. The structuring of jobs in a sequence, leading to promotion from one to another, likewise increases unemployability among workers unlikely to meet the requirements of the higher jobs in the sequence, even when they are perfectly capable of handling the job at the bottom that is actually vacant. Were the vacant job not part of such a sequence, if it were a so-called dead-end job, then a wider range of workers would be employable. Of these, some who might not have seemed promotable at the beginning may turn out to be so after being observed at work and after acquiring new skills and experience. Even those not promotable in the particular prearranged sequence may nevertheless move up in some other line of work, partly on the strength of experience and recommendations for conscientious work in the so-called dead-end jobs. Vast millions of ill-educated, unskilled immigrants from around the world, many speaking little or no English, were readily absorbed into the 19th century American economy in dead-end jobs, which in fact led upward to economic progress. In medieval England, servant girls in the homes of the rich often went on later to become owners and operators of their own inns, utilizing their knowledge of food, manners, people, and organization acquired in their previous work. Blacks similarly became prominent among caterers in 18th and 19th century America. George Washington's farewell dinner for his officers after the Revolutionary War was held in a tavern owned by a free black man. Conversely, the spread of job promotion ladders in the 20th century, whether in civil service or in corporate bureaucracies, has been accompanied by the spread of unemployability. While government policy may intentionally or unintentionally increase racial discrimination, some government policies are intended specifically to reduce discrimination. Here again, intentions or rationales do not determine actual outcomes. Economic incentives are crucial for understanding economic results. For example, if the government had passed an anti-discrimination law during the era when Jews and Gentiles both worked six-day weeks but had different Sabbaths, what incentives would this have created? The inherent costs of a mixed workforce would in no way have been reduced by the law. Clearly, the incentives would be to evade and violate the law. New businesses opening up, or existing businesses opening new branches, would have incentives to locate away from communities with mixed Jewish and Gentile populations to minimize the likelihood that there would be job applicants from the wrong group. Both Jewish and Gentile employers would have this incentive. This might lead to hiring patterns not much different from what would exist without an anti-discrimination law, or even to worse employment segregation than would have existed without the law. In the absence of an anti-discrimination law, employers primarily concerned about costs, rather than having any personal animosities toward one group or another, might hire workers from the wrong group in particular jobs where either a five-day week was feasible or where the work that was not done on Saturday, for example, could just as easily be made up on Sunday, or vice versa. Once an anti-discrimination law was in place, however, with government officials scrutinizing statistics for all occupations and examining promotions as well as hiring, then hiring people for special niches would expose the employer to costly litigation over charges of discrimination. Clearly, under these conditions, there would be even more incentives than before to have all Jewish or all Gentile workforces if the cost of locating away from concentrations of either group were not prohibitive. Given the extreme concentration of Jews during this era, more than half the Jews in the country lived on Manhattan's Lower East Side, it would not be difficult at all for a Gentile employer to locate where he was unlikely to have Jewish job applicants. An anti-discrimination law would have provided additional incentives to do so. In a later era, after the anti-discrimination laws of the 1960s, there were charges that more businesses were locating away from concentrations of black populations. If so, the anti-discrimination laws themselves may have contributed to such actions. Whether, on net balance, such laws reduce or increase discrimination is an empirical question, and the empirical evidence is by no means unambiguous. Government itself may also discriminate on the basis of race, religion, or other group characteristics. This includes employment discrimination, housing discrimination, and discrimination in the provision of a whole range of government services, from education to garbage collection, as well as government-mandated discrimination imposed on employers, landlords, or others in the private sector. The government has, in fact, been a major discriminator in countries around the world. Central Asians in the 1980s still encountered pervasive patterns of racial discrimination in the Soviet military forces, reminiscent of discrimination patterns encountered by blacks in the U.S. military services in the 1940s. South Africa became notorious throughout the world because of apartheid. Numerous black African nations have discriminated against Asians and forced them out by the tens of thousands. Government discrimination has been built into laws from the tropical South Pacific islands of Fiji to the North Atlantic island of Ireland. One of the crucial areas of discrimination by government has been in the quantity and quality of education made available to different groups, for this can have lasting effects on their productivity and career potential in the private sector as well. This kind of discrimination has occurred at many places and at various periods of history. For much of the history of Southeast Asia, the only education available to the Chinese has been that provided by the Chinese community, not by the local public education authorities. In South Africa, during the era of white rule, blacks began to be educated only after education was established for whites, and only to lower levels than whites, and with only a small fraction of the expenditure per student that whites received. East Indians in Guyana were specifically excluded from the first compulsory attendance laws in that country. In the United States, there have been not only large racial disparities in educational expenditures for much of American history, but also, during the antebellum period in parts of the South, criminal penalties for educating blacks, even at private expense. These examples, by no means exhaustive, suggest that governmental discrimination in education may so handicap particular racial and ethnic groups as to make private discrimination difficult to detect or estimate because groups end up with such different productivities as a result. Government discrimination in the provision of various other public services, police protection, garbage collection, public health services, etc., has had similarly disparate impacts on different racial and ethnic groups. The government's economic impact on particular groups is not simply a question of what specific policies it follows, but also, and perhaps more important, whether it follows any policy at all. Whether government plays a relatively minor role in the economy or as a pervasive influence can have important economic and other effects on racial matters. For example, policies designed to maintain white supremacy in the economy as elsewhere were common to the American South during the Jim Crow era and to South Africa throughout the era of white minority rule. Yet the constitutional and ideological limits on the role of government in the United States left vast areas of discretion to the private marketplace, with the net result that racist policies were less effective in stopping the economic rise of blacks in the United States as compared to South Africa. Private discrimination, even when organized into employer and landowner cartels, proved far less effective than discrimination by government, with its ultimate monopoly of force. In both countries, those white political leaders most bent on suppressing blacks were also most opposed to the operation of a free market, not simply in racial matters, but more generally. The Jim Crow era in the American South was dominated by the rise of radical populist politicians who railed against Wall Street as well as against blacks. In South Africa, too, socialist and statist thinking in general were the hallmarks of those who promoted first the color bar policies against blacks and later apartheid. In the United States, outside the South, racial and ethnic antagonisms were by no means absent, but the dominant 19th century American political philosophy of leaving the marketplace relatively free of government restrictions allowed these racial and ethnic interactions to sort themselves out, usually with less racial discrimination than in the South. That this was a market phenomenon rather than a purely regional phenomenon was indicated by a notable exception, the greater opportunities for black skilled craftsmen in the South. Northern crafts became unionized long before unionization caught on in the South. In the freer labor market for skilled craftsmen in the South, blacks fared far better than in the North. More generally, countries with active government controls and participation in their economies have tended to have more intergroup discrimination and strife than those countries in which government plays a lesser role in economic transactions. Many colonial countries, especially in the British Empire during the era of laissez-faire, had less discrimination and strife among their own peoples than in the later era of independence, when there was much expanded government role in their respective economies. This pattern can be found from Sri Lanka to Nigeria, Trinidad, Uganda, Guyana, Malaysia, Kenya, and other countries once ruled by the British. In many colonies, whether ruled by Britain or by other European colonial powers, there was far less enthusiasm for independence among minority groups than among the majority population. In the exceptional case where the British colonial authorities intervened massively to transfer vast economic resources, notably land ownership, in Ireland under Cromwell, they created the same discrimination, intergroup bitterness, and enduring strife as in other countries with similar policies. The kinds of institutions through which discrimination is attempted profoundly affect the degree to which it is likely to be carried out and continued. Because arbitrary discrimination against groups is inherently costly to the economy, these costs may be shuffled around in various ways, but do not disappear. Insofar as the marketplace remains free to convey these costs to decision makers, it creates a deterrent whose impact has been manifest in even the most racist societies. Conversely, merely to call some other social phenomenon discrimination and outlaw it does not necessarily benefit the intended beneficiaries, and may in fact reduce their employment opportunities. Housing, quantity and quality. Housing is a very heterogeneous product, ranging from hovels to mansions, so the supply and demand for this product in a culturally heterogeneous population offers highly varied possibilities, as does the perception of the outcomes by heterogeneous observers. Many observers have been appalled by the housing inhabited by people of a different class, race, or national origin. Sometimes this is reflected simply a difference in income between the observers and the inhabitants, the latter being unable to afford anything better. At other times, however, the housing choices have reflected different goals or different trade-offs among goals. Italian men living as immigrants or sojourners, whether in Europe, the Western Hemisphere, or Australia, have been among the more extreme examples of a group with minimal demands for housing, both quantitatively and qualitatively. During the era of mass emigration from Italy, it was not uncommon for several Italian men overseas to share a single room when they were saving to take money back home or to bring their families over to join them. This did not mean that housing was unimportant to Italians. On the contrary, once the family was reunited in a new country, housing often became such a high priority that extraordinary efforts and sacrifices then went into buying their own homes. This might include children as well as adults working and all living within very strict limits so as to accumulate a down payment on a family home. Middleman minorities overseas, such as the Chinese in Southeast Asia, the Lebanese in West Africa, or the Indians in East Africa, have likewise often had an initial demand for housing that was minimal in quantity and quality, as the men saved for both business and family reasons, while the mass emigration of Jews, such as transferred the center of world Jewry from Eastern Europe to the United States, was often a refugee flight of whole families. Their initial housing demands, too, were often limited, not simply by income, but also by high savings propensities found, for example, in the run-down neighborhoods on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. In short, for these groups, as for the Italians, housing choices, as of a given time, reflected long-run plans, as well as short-run trade-offs. All this tended to be ignored by observers shocked at these groups' housing conditions, and especially by social reformers determined to do something about it. Seldom have the crusades of social reformers been directed toward enlarging the set of options available to the groups whose housing the reformers disapproved. More commonly, housing reform efforts have reduced the existing options, whether by slum clearance programs that destroyed lower quality housing, by building codes that forbade construction of housing without amenities prescribed by reformers, or by other regulations limiting the number of persons living in a given space to what reformers found acceptable. In all these ways, less fortunate groups were forced to pay more for housing than they themselves chose. Their incomes could no longer be used to maximize their own satisfactions, according to their own values, goals, and trade-offs, but were partially diverted to making observers feel better. Reformers often found it sufficient justification to point out the objective fact of improvement in average housing quality in the wake of their reforms. However, this improvement, paid for by higher rents charged the tenants, was equally available before the reforms if the tenants valued the improvements as much as they valued alternative uses of the same money. Nor should it be imagined that housing quality today would be at the low levels of a century ago without housing reforms. Rising incomes tend to produce rising housing quality, whether or not there is government intervention in housing markets. This applies not only to changes from one era to another, but also to changes within the lifespan of given individuals, as among groups who achieve eventual home ownership by initially paying low rents for lower qualities and smaller quantities of housing. Other groups, such as the Jews or the overseas Chinese, have tended to invest such savings in business or in the education of their children. Looked at more generally, in a world where people have multidimensional goals, all constrained within the limits of their wealth-generating capacity, government intervention can always improve one dimension and document that improvement objectively as a success, ignoring the other dimensions sacrificed. Housing is only a special case of that general principle. As with other special cases, the dimension chosen for enhancement is typically one visible to observers, while those dimensions sacrificed are less visible. The future, being necessarily invisible, is often sacrificed, as is the present inner satisfaction of working toward a goal of having home ownership, business ownership, higher education for one's children, the independence of having some savings put aside, or the capacity to send for parents or other relatives, or to help them get established in a new setting. All such goals are retarded or destroyed when third parties are able to force tenants to pay higher rents for amenities chosen by third parties at the expense of goals chosen by themselves. Such impositions of outsiders' values and preferences have been especially prevalent when reformers have come from a different cultural background and have had little understanding of or respect for the choices of the people involved. This, in turn, has been especially common where reformers have had more years of formal schooling and could therefore feel justified in dismissing the choices of others as uninformed and unintelligent. The most dangerous kind of ignorance is the ignorance of the educated. One of the leading advocates of social reform during the late 19th century in New York was journalist Jacob Riis, who detailed the overcrowded and squalid living conditions in various immigrant neighborhoods. Yet Riis also noted in passing the collusion of tenants with their landlords to evade the new housing reform laws, and indeed the tenants' sometimes violent resistance to being evicted by the authorities from housing officially condemned as substandard and marked for demolition. Such observations did not lead Riis to re-examine his own assumptions, but were presented in passing as anomalies or perversities. Similar attempts to evade benefits chosen for them by others were apparent earlier, in the mid-19th century, when the British government passed laws mandating better living conditions on ships carrying emigrants overseas. The conditions on the ships of that era were truly appalling, by all accounts, Yet Irish emigrants rushed to get on those ships before the deadline for improvement, indicating that the lower fares were more important to them than the improvements in the conditions under which they would be housed during the voyage. Housing segregation. It is a common pattern in many countries around the world for different racial and ethnic groups to concentrate in different communities or neighborhoods, or even on particular streets. German emigrants created whole German towns and villages overseas, from Herman, Missouri, in the United States, to Blumenau in Brazil and Handorf in Australia. The Welsh in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, or the Scots in Dunedin, New Zealand, are among other groups that have done the same. A more usual pattern is for particular groups to concentrate in particular sections of a town or city. Chinatowns, from Melbourne to Toronto, being perhaps the best known examples of this residential pattern. Often there has been still further differentiation within the ethnic ghetto. Within Jewish neighborhoods on the Lower East Side of Manhattan during the immigrant era, for example, Hungarian Jews concentrated in different sections from the Polish Jews, and German Jews tended to live far from this whole Eastern European Jewish settlement. Italians living in Buenos Aires, New York, or Toronto have likewise concentrated residentially, according to their own or ancestral regional origins, in Italy. Most of these pervasive housing segregation patterns, including minute subdivisions within ethnic enclaves, have not been visible to the naked eye, as, for example, black-white housing segregation is in the United States. There has been a tendency to refer to the latter racial residential segregation patterns as if they were unique, when in fact they are uniquely visible. The pattern known as white flight, the exodus of whites from a neighborhood when blacks begin moving in, is likewise part of a much larger, if less visible, phenomenon. Jewish immigrants at particular levels of acculturation have moved out of Chicago neighborhoods as less acculturated Jews moved in. Native-born Americans have moved out as Irish immigrants moved in. Indeed, middle-class blacks have moved away as lower-class blacks moved in, or have left neighborhoods in Detroit to get away from Polish immigrants, and left neighborhoods in Manhattan to get away from the Irish. Such residential flight patterns are not peculiar to the United States. In the Caribbean, the same pattern can be seen between descendants of people from India, called East Indians in the Caribbean, and people of African ancestry, called Creoles. As a scholarly study found, where East Indians settled, Creoles generally departed. In Australia, influxes of Southern European immigrants into residential neighborhoods have led to an exodus of Australians of British ancestry. People sort themselves out residentially around the world, not only by race and ethnicity, but also by income, education, lifestyle, and other characteristics. The degree or severity of housing segregation differs from group to group, as well as for the same groups in different cities of the same country, and varies from one era to another. Residential segregation also differs in whether it represents a chosen clustering or an exclusion maintained by others, whether by custom, agreement, or law. Observers who presuppose that a random distribution of people is desirable often see residential sorting as a problem to be solved, usually by governmental action. Often this view is accompanied by an assumption that housing segregation is irrational or can only be an expression of prejudice or animosity toward other groups. In reality, there can be very high costs associated with a random distribution of people, in housing even more than in employment. Indeed, some of the most pervasive and enduring employment segregation has occurred where workers have been housed together for long periods on railroad or canal construction projects, or as migrant agricultural laborers. The benefits of housing segregation are obvious in the case of groups who speak a different language from that of the surrounding society. If literally distributed randomly across a large country such as Australia, Canada, or the United States, non-English-speaking individuals could find themselves virtually isolated from the rest of the human race. Residential segregation allows such individuals to enjoy not only the company of compatriots, but also a pooling of knowledge, often slowly or even painfully acquired, about the larger society to which they are all adjusting. There are, of course, costs as well as benefits from residential segregation. Insularity, delayed acculturation, and delayed understanding of other groups are among these costs. It is as unnecessary as it is impossible to determine the net balance of these costs and benefits, for they vary from individual to individual, and even for the same individual at different stages of development. Government policy, expressed in a law, cannot, of course, take all these differences and nuances into account, whether or not that policy is to promote or reduce housing segregation. Governments around the world have done both, and in some cases, in the United States, for example, the same government has followed opposite policies at different times. The federal government explicitly promoted housing segregation by law during one era, and then banned it by law less than half a century later. In a free market, the costs and benefits of housing segregation are conveyed to individual transactors in economic terms. To the individual landlord, the cost of discriminating against particular groups can be a longer vacancy period, during which idle units earn no rent, as otherwise qualified tenants are turned away for belonging to the wrong group. Alternatively, the landlord can reduce the vacancy periods by reducing rents so as to keep his housing units fully rented with tenants from the right groups. Either way, the landlord must pay a price for his own discrimination. Particularly when the landlord himself does not live in the housing he rents, these costs are likely to be borne only when alternative courses of action would create even greater costs, whether because the excluded groups are more destructive than average toward housing, or are sufficiently unpopular that other tenants tend to vacate when they move in. Seldom, however, is either the behavior of one group or the reactions of the other group completely uniform. This opens the way to the kinds of incremental adjustments common in a marketplace, as distinguished from the categorical policies of government. Where different portions of each group differ culturally from the other group to varying degrees, or have different levels of tolerance toward others, those portions of each group most similar to one another tend to have the lowest costs of living near each other. For example, in the later colonial era in Ceylon, and during the early years of its independence, educated Tamils and educated Sinhalese both spoke English and lived a westernized lifestyle, which made it easier for them to live near each other and for both to live apart from their respective ethnic groups, who spoke separate languages and followed separate traditional lifestyles. For some racial and ethnic groups in the United States, the expansion of the ethnic enclave has tended to be led by individuals and families more acculturated to the norms of the larger society, and who pioneer in moving into neighborhoods formerly off-limits to the group in question. Blacks, Jews, and others have exhibited this pattern. Studies of ethnic enclaves in various American cities have shown different residential zones within each enclave, corresponding to different economic and cultural levels, with the more prosperous and most acculturated zones being on the periphery of the enclave. The enclave's expansion into the wider society thus tends to be led by those likely to encounter the least resistance, although in some cases even the least resistance may be formidable, especially if the existing residents sense an entering wedge behind which far more people of far less acceptability will ultimately arrive. By contrast, government promotion of residential integration of groups tends to be both cruder and more costly. Either an unsorted collection of people from different groups will be put together in public housing, for example, or the less educated, lower-income members of different groups, people with disintegrating families and higher levels of vandalism, crime, and violence, will be concentrated in housing projects set in the neighborhood of a different group. This can be a costly process for both groups in terms of the enduring animosities and sometimes violence generated. Social reformers seeking to unsort people who have sorted themselves often assume that housing segregation patterns will endure indefinitely through inertia without outside intervention. History as well as logic undermine that belief. As individuals and families acculturate, they tend to move residentially to be with others of similar values or lifestyles. These moves may be within a given ethnic enclave or series of enclaves, or may involve moving out into the larger society. Similarly, as whole groups change culturally over time, their acceptability as neighbors changes as well. Irish immigrants to the United States in the 19th century were notorious for fighting, for alcoholism, for keeping farm animals in city neighborhoods, and for garbage and filth that made their communities prey to disease. Cholera was unknown in Boston until the Irish settled there in the mid-19th century, and cholera epidemics also concentrated in Irish neighborhoods in New York. At that juncture in history, the cost of having the Irish immigrants dispersed at random in American cities would have been an even wider ruin of neighborhoods and an even greater spread of deadly diseases. With the passage of the years, and with internal improvement efforts by the Irish themselves, led by the Catholic Church, the Irish began to rise from this condition, a whole class of lace-curtain Irish separating themselves from the shanty Irish. Eventually, the Irish as a whole group were widely accepted residentially and socially, and became largely dispersed among the general population. Similar adjustments of residential patterns to social realities have occurred across the color line. Even before the American Civil War, free blacks began to move out of the South and into northern urban communities, though in small numbers compared to the mass exodus of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. As a people brought into Western civilization at the bottom, many of these blacks required years of acculturation to new circumstances and new requirements of urban living as a free people. The reaction of the white population to their presence was largely negative and even antagonistic. One of many consequences of this was residential segregation. However, by the late 19th century, there were many indications that a culturally changed black population faced changed social attitudes, now expressed in wider access to residential housing. In New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Chicago, and in cities outside the South in general, there were many relaxations or eliminations of previous racial restrictions. Greater access to housing was just one of these changes, which included greater access to public accommodations, as well as more voting rights and more social acceptance across racial lines. The period from 1870 to 1890, especially, has been called an unprecedented period of racial amity and integration in the North. In short, blind inertia did not prevent changing realities, such as the growing acculturation of blacks, from being reflected in economic transactions as well as in social interactions. However, a mass exodus of blacks out of the South, beginning in the 1890s and accelerating in the early 20th century, not only greatly increased the black urban population numerically, but also changed its character culturally. The new mass exodus of blacks from the South represented far less acculturated people, people whose behavior was widely decried within the black community as well as by whites. In the wake of this migration, the previous racial progress in housing and other areas not only halted, but reversed. Where all black neighborhoods had once been rare or non-existent in various cities, Chicago, New York, Washington, Philadelphia, or Detroit, for example, the familiar black ghettos of the 20th century now took shape. In short, where social realities have substantially changed the costs of intergroup residential integration, whether positively or negatively, the market has responded accordingly. With housing segregation, as with employment segregation, the crucial question is whether the situation involves real, substantial, and inherent costs, or mere perceptions and stereotypes. Where the costs of association are real, whether based on language differences or behavioral differences, these costs cannot be made to disappear by fiat. Where spontaneous sorting processes are free to operate, they tend to minimize these costs, and where preconceived patterns of unsorted housing are imposed, as in government housing projects, the higher social costs tend to be manifested in heightened intergroup hostility and violence. Real costs must be paid, whether in money or in other ways, including bloodshed. Goods and services. Markets for consumer goods and services are typically competitive markets. Yet in racially heterogeneous societies, there are often charges of monopoly or exploitation in such markets, often due to economic phenomena which are an expression of that heterogeneity. Monopoly. The harmfulness of monopoly is well established in elementary economics. Politically, however, the term monopoly is often used quite loosely to describe a wide variety of situations, including highly competitive markets. For example, the Lebanese were once said to monopolize the textile trade in parts of West Africa because they were the most prominent businessmen in that trade, even though they competed actively against one another in the marketplace. In much the same way, the Chinese have often been said to monopolize various economic sectors in a variety of countries, even though others remained free to enter those sectors and compete. Indeed, monopoly has even been alleged as a general characteristic of middleman minorities. But where there is no power to exclude, there is no economically meaningful monopoly, even if the sellers are all of the same race or nationality. Political use of the term monopoly may in fact produce policies that reduce competition. Ethnic minorities said to monopolize particular sectors of the economy may be restricted in immigrating into the country or in setting up new businesses, the net effect of which is to insulate existing businesses from competition and permit higher prices at the expense of consumers. While such policies may be imposed in hopes of permitting others, especially indigenous majorities, to set up businesses, it by no means follows that they will do so, or that this will result in more indigenous businesses overall if they do. Where less efficient indigenous businesses survive under the protection of such restrictions, the goods and services they provide cost consumers more, leaving less to spend on other purchases that could support other businesses, indigenous and otherwise. In short, loose use of the word monopoly, in a political sense quite different from its economic meaning, often leads to policies reducing competition and thus producing the very monopolistic results so loudly denounced. The real hallmark of a genuine monopoly, enduring profits above the earnings level of competitive enterprises, is seldom shown in situations where particular groups, foreign or domestic, are said to have a monopoly. The initial investors, or even the initial wave of investors in a newly developing economy, may earn above average profits for a time, as they did in the early stages of foreign investment in Tsarist Russia, but the sharp decline in profits there, from 17.5% per annum to under 3% in just 11 years, suggests something of the power of competition. Exploitation. Where sellers, moneylenders, or other economic transactors are predominantly of one group and the buyers, borrowers, etc. are from another group, charges of exploitation are common, though not commonly supported by evidence. In a heterogeneous population, credit availability and interest rates may vary with the repayment prospects of individual borrowers or groups of borrowers. Where those less likely to repay find credit less available, or available only at higher interest rates, that is not exploitation, but higher charges to offset higher rates of default. The problem is to distinguish this situation from a situation where one group simply colludes to charge another group interest rates higher than those of a competitive market. The power of moneylenders in poor peasant societies has been a common refrain. However, the evidence does not fit this picture. Often such moneylending groups as the Chinese in Southeast Asia, the Jews in Europe, or the Indians in Burma have simply lent, at high interest rates, to people whom others would not lend to at all, or would lend to only at even higher interest rates, or only with collateral that the borrowers did not possess. If the problem were in fact one of extortionate gains by existing lenders with power, then alternative lenders would find the field profitable. But when the government of Burma, for example, attempted to prevent exploitation of Burmese peasants by Indian moneylenders, by itself extending credit to the peasants, the government suffered great losses on these loans. In Malaysia, where the government likewise established a bank to provide alternative sources of credit to Malays, supposedly exploited by the Chinese, this bank, in fact, extended credit primarily to the Chinese, the Indians, and foreigners, all of whom were rated better credit risks than the Malays. Where Malaysian government loans have been made to indigenous borrowers, the incidence of bad debts has been high. In short, the interest rates previously charged in a free market had conveyed an economic reality, not some mysterious power of Chinese or Indian moneylenders. In some cases, interest is not charged separately, but is included in the prices of goods purchased on credit. In a heterogeneous population, that can mean different prices charged for the same item when purchased by individuals from different racial, ethnic, or other backgrounds. When such practices were discovered in American multi-ethnic neighborhoods by sociologists, there were claims that, one, the poor pay more, and that, two, pricing was racially discriminatory. This situation is not, however, fundamentally different from the charging of different interest rates to groups with different repayment records. The relevant question is whether, in fact, the repayment prospects of different groups are the same or different. The question actually asked in research on this issue has been quite different: whether matched individuals from different groups are charged different prices. This presupposes a negligible cost of knowledge in determining whether individuals vary from their group average in the repayment of credit. Even in the absence of an empirical test of the hypothesis of group exploitation in interest rates, it is clear on general economic principles that an overcharged group or a group denied credit on terms that their repayment prospects would justify provide an especially profitable opportunity for other lenders. Once again, the question is, what is the actual reality as distinguished from perceptions or stereotypes? Knowledge cost may make lending seem more risky to given lenders than the reality would reveal. During the era of mass Italian immigration to the United States, for example, American bankers may well have been unaware of both the high saving propensities and the reliable repayment patterns of the Italian immigrants. However, those within the Italian-American community were well aware of these facts and created their own institutions to profit from that knowledge. A bank established in California called itself the Bank of Italy in order to attract the business of the Italian immigrants. It became so successful that its branches spread across the state, attracting business far beyond its initial clientele, and ultimately becoming the largest bank in the world, under a new name, the Bank of America. While it is possible for those within a given ethnic group to recognize the economic realities of the group faster than outsiders can, it is not necessary for the group to have its own bankers or other economic transactors for that reality to make itself felt in the marketplace. Initially, poor Lebanese immigrants established such a reputation for creditworthiness in Sierra Leone that they were able to get merchandise on credit from European businesses there, thereby facilitating their success as retailers. Similarly, the reliability of Germans from Russia in repaying loans caused them to be able to get farm mortgages on very favorable terms from American banks. Conversely, where repayment prospects are less favorable, that reality too can make itself felt in the marketplace, both the lenders inside and outside the ethnic group. Black-owned banks in the United States have tended to have high rates of failure, and the surviving black banks have tended to invest outside their community even more than white banks. When a study of lending institutions in the United States showed that black applicants for mortgage loans were turned down at a significantly higher rate than white applicants, this was widely regarded as proof of racial discrimination, even though this study did not control for previous credit history or existing debt levels among the applicants. It also did not take into account differences in net worth between blacks and whites, though whites tend to have a larger net worth than blacks in general, or even blacks in the same income bracket. Indeed, blacks in the highest income bracket do not average as much net worth as whites in the second highest income bracket. As with so many studies of statistical disparities between groups, this study did not examine the disparities in the underlying factors behind the results. Moreover, the underlying reasoning ignores the fact that lending is not done as a favor by lenders to loan recipients, but as a way for lenders to make money for themselves. Although goods and services can vary in price because of differences in the implicit interest charged to groups with different credit risks, sometimes the prices of goods and services vary with the neighborhood rather than with the individual or group. Here, too, often the poor pay more because they live in neighborhoods with higher costs of providing those goods and services. Higher than average rates of crime or vandalism obviously increase the costs of doing business, including not only the losses directly suffered, but also the costs of more security devices needed to control losses, iron grates for storefronts, or security guards in and around the stores, for example. There are other and more indirect costs, but costs that are very real and very consequential, nevertheless. Both labor and management tend to be less willing to work in unpleasant neighborhoods, meaning that stores and other businesses there must either pay higher wages and salaries to attract the same quality personnel as work in other neighborhoods, or, more likely, be content with poorer quality personnel offering poorer services to the customer at higher prices, and with no additional profit to show for it. Many large chains of supermarkets, department stores, and other businesses may simply not maintain stores in less desirable neighborhoods, rather than face these problems or compromise their general reputation for quality. Economically, these are not mere questions of perceptions or stereotypes. Where an underlying reality differs from the general perception, there are more lucrative profit opportunities for those with more accurate knowledge. But where the reality does not differ substantially from the perception, then different prices, interest rates, or credit availability can persist indefinitely, or until the reality itself changes. Exploitation theories in general imply that higher rates of profit are obtained from those found in competitive markets. The normal fluctuations of prices, sales, and costs can produce transiently higher or low profits, even in a competitive market. Exploitation implies persistently higher than average profits, but evidence of persistent profits above the norm is seldom offered to support the exploitation thesis. Slum landlords or sweatshop operators during the American mass immigration era apparently did not make particularly high profits. By the late 20th century, many businesses were moving out of black ghettos, an action hardly suggesting special profitability. Internationally, the relatively hasty withdrawal of European imperial powers from their colonies in Africa and Asia during the 1950s and 1960s, in many cases with no armed uprisings by the colonial peoples, likewise suggests that there were no vast profits being made to justify a real struggle to maintain control. Where there were bitter armed struggles, as in Algeria or Kenya, for example, it was often because of a large expatriate European community born and raised in the colonies, and unwilling to give up its protected and privileged status there, not because of huge profits going to overseas corporations. Implications. Economics often assumes a homogeneous population, simply in order to keep the analysis from becoming needlessly complicated. This assumption, however, is not fundamental to the analysis. When applying economic principles to racial and ethnic groups, the heterogeneity of the population cannot be ignored, and is in fact fundamental to the situation. Behavioral differences between groups can impose costs on either or both. If one group is more prone to crime or disease, that imposes costs on any other group in contact with them, whether at work or living in the same neighborhood. Where there are language differences, costs are imposed on both groups. Such costs are real and do not depend upon perceptions or stereotypes, nor do they necessarily entail prejudice or animosity. People tend to try to minimize their own costs in various ways, such as job segregation, residential segregation, or the offering of different credit terms to different groups. The competitive pressures of the marketplace not only reflect these cost differences, but also respond to behavioral changes that raise or lower the costs of intergroup transactions. Government policies which attempt to produce a homogeneity of results, despite a heterogeneity of behavior, have the net effect of creating incentives for private transactors to reduce economic transactions. This reduction can take the form of fewer employment opportunities in the wake of minimum wage laws, or less credit available after interest rate ceilings are imposed by usury laws, for example. The impact of such reduced economic opportunities tends to fall disproportionately on the initially less fortunate group, which is to say, the group whose reality differs most from the implicit assumption of homogeneity behind the policy. A special case of attempts to produce homogeneous results in heterogeneous populations are affirmative action policies, which a number of countries have initiated under various labels, such as positive discrimination, India, standardization, Sri Lanka, or reflecting the federal character of the country, Nigeria. The actual impact of such policies has been highly disparate, as between the initially more fortunate members of the officially preferred groups, who have gained the lion's share of the benefits, while less fortunate members of these groups have sometimes actually fallen further behind the general population under policies designed to benefit them. Such results are far less surprising when seen in the perspective of economics, as a study of incentives and their consequences, rather than rationales and their goals. Economics is a study of cause and effect, not intentions and hopes. Those who judge policies by their good intentions, or who presuppose that unhappy economic situations are a result of bad intentions, often see economic adjustments to real differences as simply racial discrimination. However, for the concept of racial discrimination to have either analytical or moral significance, it must be distinguished from the mere economic reflection of actual differences among groups. That distinction often gets lost in political discussions of discrimination, and sometimes even in scholarly discussions. If all differences between the earnings, occupations, and employment rates of different groups are simply defined as discrimination, then it is circular reasoning to say that discrimination causes these differences, and compounded meaninglessness to quantify these effects of discrimination. The reiteration of assumptions in the midst of statistics does not constitute evidence. Once the possibility of economic performance differences between groups is admitted, then differences in income, occupational representation, and the like do not in themselves imply that decision makers took race or ethnicity into account. However, in other cases, group membership may in fact be used as a proxy for economically meaningful variables, rather than reflecting either mistaken prejudices or even subjective affinities and animosities. A study in the United States, for example, found that black landlords as well as white landlords preferred white tenants. The familiar linking of group prejudice to economic discrimination, and that, in turn, to income disparities, assumes away both behavioral or performance differences among groups and the economic cost of indulging unfounded beliefs in a competitive market. The effectiveness of economic competition does not depend on any employer's awakening to his own enlightened self-interest. Even if some employers are incapable of changing their minds, the marketplace is not incapable of changing which individuals can continue to survive as employers. The same is true for landlords, moneylenders, and other economic transactors. Being wrong may be a free good for intellectuals, judges, or the media, but not for economic transactors competing in the marketplace. The cost of group discrimination explains why it is not generally as prevalent as a mere listing of economic disparities might suggest, and also why its prevalence varies greatly in different kinds of economic markets. Conversely, the less any enterprise's survival depends upon economic efficiency, the less is the inefficiency of discriminatory behavior an effective deterrent. Government agencies, which derive their support from the national treasury, clearly do not depend upon economic efficiency for their survival. The costs of discrimination to society as a whole may be just as high when done in a government agency as in a private enterprise, but the actual income of decision-makers who discriminate is unaffected in a government agency, however much it may cost the taxpayers. On the simplest economic principles, more discrimination would be expected where its costs are less, and that is what is found empirically. In many countries, governments have long been the most discriminatory employers, whether ordinary discrimination or reverse discrimination under affirmative action. For similar reasons, government-regulated public utilities have likewise been very prominent among discriminatory employers, again, whether ordinary discriminators or practitioners of reverse discrimination. While privately owned utilities earn profits, their rates of profit are limited to levels determined by government regulatory agencies. As an unregulated monopoly, a utility company supplying electricity, for example, might be able to charge $5 for a given quantity of electricity and earn a 20% return on its investment, operating at maximum efficiency. But if a regulatory agency has determined that 8% is the limit of what the company will be permitted to earn, then the corresponding price of the same electricity might be $4, again, operating at maximum efficiency. Under regulation, however, there is less incentive to operate at maximum efficiency. Prejudices of the company's management or labor can be indulged, even if this increases costs, for these costs will then justify higher prices to consumers, as long as the profit rate does not rise above 8%. If the same amount of electricity that would cost $4 under maximum efficiency now costs $6 with group discrimination, the utility company has lost nothing, even though the public may lose millions of dollars. Given these economic incentives, it is hardly surprising that American telephone companies were in one era among the most discriminatory employers toward blacks, and just a few years later, among the employers with strong preferential hiring of blacks. Neither policy was costly to them. Nonprofit organizations, such as universities, are likewise under less pressure to maintain maximum economic efficiency, for their higher costs are treated as showing a need for the donations which keep them going, or can politically justify dipping into their endowments. Similarly, foundations can use more of their money for meeting their own internal needs when costs are higher, as they are with discriminatory hiring. Like regulated public utilities, universities, foundations, and other nonprofit organizations were once especially notorious for their discrimination against blacks, and no more than a generation later, became especially prominent among practitioners of preferential hiring of blacks under affirmative action. Not all interactions among different racial and ethnic groups are economically motivated. These interactions often are, however, economically constrained. Understanding the nature and principles of these economic constraints means adding a new dimension to an understanding of racial and ethnic issues.